This is VOA News. I'm Philip Alexio. Across parts of northeastern Syria, with U.S. military outposts and bases emptied or destroyed after Washington withdrew from the region, the fallout began to roll in the form of Russian armored troop carriers. The reinforcements arriving on Friday, according to Russian media, with an additional 300 Russian military police and 20 armored vehicles preparing to deploy along the Syrian-Turkish border as part of the deal Moscow negotiated with Ankara to end the fighting with Kurdish forces who until now were backed by the United States. A Kurdish family in Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is anguished by news that 31-year-old Ali Wazir set himself on fire Wednesday outside a United Nations building in Geneva, Switzerland. Wazir, a Syrian Kurdish refugee residing in Germany, suffered burns on 80% of his body after setting himself on fire at the headquarters of the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. His family says it was an act of self-immolation to draw global attention to Turkish attacks on the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces in northeast Syria. Police say the discovery of 39 bodies in the back of a container truck in southeastern England is one of Britain's worst human smuggling cases. Police initially said the migrants were Chinese citizens, but said Friday this is a developing picture. And Vietnamese families have come forward saying they fear that their loved ones might be among the victims. Martin Passmore is the detective and chief inspector for the Essex Police.
We don't know exactly the nationality of our individuals, but at the moment I'm going to focus and engage as much as I possibly can within the Vietnamese community.
Police have arrested four suspects, including the driver of the truck, in connection with the case. This is VOA News. The U.S. military says there are now fewer than 150 Islamic State fighters left in Libya. That's a huge reduction from earlier this year, when an AFRICOM official said Islamic State had as many as 750 members in Libya. Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has details.
Speaking exclusively to VOA, U.S. Africa Command's Director of Public Affairs, Colonel Chris Carnes, said the military saw a regeneration of Islamic State forces and, with coordination from the Libyan government, decided to strike.
So they were gathering in camps where they were doing some of the basic training and starting to do some of the recruiting, and consequently airstrikes were conducted. So 43 Islamic State fighters have been taken out of Libya permanently. Right now, when you look at the numbers, it's under 150.
The deteriorating security situation allowed the militants to expand their presence in ungoverned spaces. Troops affiliated with the Government of National Accord are battling forces led by strongman Khalifa Haftar, killing hundreds of people caught in the middle of the fight this year. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
At least 42 people were killed in Iraq on Friday when security forces used tear gas and an Iranian-backed militia opened fire to try to quell renewed demonstrations against corruption and economic hardship. The Iraqi Human Rights Commission said at least 30 people were killed by gunshots or tear gas canisters in the capital and four southern provinces. 12 died in the southern city of Diwania alone. Well, despite the impeachment process the Democrats are pushing, President Trump continues to receive some strong support from the Republican National Committee. Mike Gracia reports.
Amid an ongoing impeachment investigation, the Republican National Committee is doubling down on its support for the president. As he was leaving the White House Friday, President Donald Trump again blasted the impeachment investigation being conducted by House Democrats.
This isn't a takedown of the president. This is a takedown of the Republican Party.
Later in a vote by phone, the Republican National Committee's governing body unanimously approved a resolution of support for the president. And echoing criticism voiced by congressional Republicans, the RNC called on Democrats to conduct the impeachment investigation like a hearing and provide President Trump with due process to include the ability to confront his accusers and call witnesses on his behalf.
Firefighters in California simultaneously fighting blazes in both the north and south of the state with 9 active fires Friday. The two largest fires are located north of Los Angeles and in the northern wine country. The Los Angeles Times describing the conditions as one of the worst periods of fire weather in a generation. I'm Philip Alexio, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The results will be judged according to the law, and the ultimate decision of the Electoral Commission will reflect what is stipulated in the law, and then wait until the endorsement by the Constitutional Council.
The Mozambican National Electoral Commission plans to announce the results of the general election Sunday.
These results are too clean. These results, you know, are unbelievable. And I'm just, you know, the first to say that I reject the results unconditionally.
A Botswana opposition leader rejects the results of the October 23 general election.
The government says the increased funding of the university. So why is the university still extorting a lot of money from the students? So we want that government to look into it. Then, as students, we are not stopping our demonstration till the university agrees to our demand.
And Ugandan university students petition President Yoweri Museveni and Parliament over rising fees. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Mozambican National Electoral Commission plans to release the results of the general election Sunday, according to Paulo Quinica, the spokesperson for the electoral body. He says the commission will meet Saturday with all stakeholders, including political party groups, poll observers, and the media to address their concerns before announcing the outcome of the elections. But the main opposition party, RENAMO, has rejected the results and is calling for the cancellation and a rerun of the polls. For the latest regarding the Mozambican elections, I reach Electoral Commission spokesperson Paulo Quinica in the capital, Maputo.
The Electoral Commission is going to meet today on its National Assembly to decide on the results. At this event, the representative of the political parties will be allowed to participate, as well as journalists and observers. After this ceremony, the results will then be released on Sunday at 2 o'clock p.m. in Maputo City. The approval of the results on Saturday may be contested by the political parties, and the commission should answer to the queries of the political parties. And then if the political parties are not satisfied, will then appeal to the Constitutional Council, which is ultimately responsible for endorsing and declaring the winner of the election.
If the political parties who are complaining that the elections were not legitimate raise the issue Saturday, how long will it take the National Electoral Commission to address their concerns before releasing the final confirmed results tomorrow?
The Electoral Commission has to answer still on Saturday. So this meeting may last very long, with a break for the preparation of the answers to the complaints of the political parties.
The main opposition party, RENAMO, and other civil society groups have said that the elections were not transparent and credible, citing uneven playing field. Have these political parties presented officially their concerns to you? And what is the National Electoral Commission going to do about this in anticipation of releasing the results tomorrow, Sunday?
Complaints follow three stages. One happens at the polling station, where complaints may be given to the presiding officer. And if the political parties are not satisfied, they appeal to the district court. And if they're not satisfied with the answer from the decision of the district court, they appeal to the Constitutional Council. And another mechanism is when the National Electoral Commission decides on the results on Saturday, where the representatives of the political parties will complain to the National Electoral Commission. And the Electoral Commission has the obligation to answer to those complaints before the session ends, I mean the National Assembly. If they are not satisfied with the decision of the National Electoral Commission, then they have to appeal to the Constitutional Council, while the National Electoral Commission will announce the results on Sunday.
I'm sure you've heard the news where RENAMO held news conferences and releasing press statements saying that there's need for the elections to be cancelled and rerun because of concerns they have about the process and voter irregularities. Does that mean that the Electoral Commission will not consider their request for the cancellation of the results since the Electoral Commission is scheduled to announce the final results of the general election on Sunday?
The appeals presented at the district level have been decided there. I'm not sure whether they have appealed to the Constitutional Council, whilst the Electoral Commission has to decide on the results. So to the decision of the National Electoral Commission, the political parties may still complain. So this is the mechanism at the district level and at the national level.
So what is the message to the people of Mozambique as you're ready to release the results on Sunday?
It's for the people of Mozambique to keep quiet and calm. The results will be judged according to the law. And the ultimate decision of the Electoral Commission will reflect what is stipulated in the law, and then wait until the endorsement by the Constitutional Council.
Paulo Quinica is the spokesperson for the Mozambican National Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from Maputo. Biggie Butali, leader of the opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, or BPF, says he does not accept the outcome of the October 23 general election. The opposition leader says he plans to soon present evidence that will show that the polls were neither transparent nor credible. Botswana's Chief Justice Terence Runawe announced that President Mokgweetsi Masisi has won a five-year term. To learn more about the opposition leader's rejection of the outcome of Wednesday's polls, I reached Biggie Butali, leader of the Botswana Patriotic Front, BPF.
We pulled the biggest crowds to our rallies. There was a vibe. People thought that something new was happening. And then when the results came out, it was just utter shock. What actually happened was that the ruling party, for the first time in 50 years, managed to sweep the whole of the south, more or less, starting with the capital city. Most capital cities in Africa are opposition strongholds, but the ruling party managed to win every single council seat in the capital city, along with all the parliamentary seats, and in all the neighboring areas of the capital city, something that has never been done in 50 years. And the margins were just huge. Even across the constituencies, the margins were more or less similar, as if they were computer generated. But I think that the coming days, we'll be able to know how this miracle happened, even though it was a miracle.
Some are saying this is a true reflection of what the Afro Barometer poll said, that the ruling party, the BDP, will win by a landslide. And this is a confirmation of it, which the opposition kicked against as unscientific. Isn't this a reflection of the Afro Barometer poll days before the election?
What I actually think happened is that the Afro Barometer poll was generated by the government of Botswana. And it's self-fulfilling prophecy. So it doesn't make it any more credible. I know this will sound far-fetched, but I think that there was some collusion somewhere.
Now, so what went wrong for the opposition? Because the opposition said you are coming up with an alliance. You even strategically placed your candidates in certain areas to maximize your effort. But all your efforts appear to have been dashed, with Motswana going for the ruling party.
Well, we had come up with a strategic alliance. We were strong in the north. We managed to carry the north. We bought about 14 seats in the north. But the opposition collapsed in the south, in their stronghold. People are saying that we were concentrating more in the north. The former president should have gone to the cities in the south as well. But the collapse is unnatural. You know, the trajectory of the votes in the south, particularly in the capital city, have been going upwards for the opposition. And all of a sudden, like I said, the opposition did not even win a single council seat in the five constituencies in the capital city. The opposition also lost the neighboring constituencies of Mochudi, Tokweng, Ramotswa, and Mohoritane. And I don't know how or what convinced these young people to go and vote the ruling party almost to the man. But I think in the coming days, in the coming years, the story will be told.
Are you therefore doubting the credibility of the election as not a true reflection of what happened?
Well, I'm one of the few opposition leaders that have openly said that I do not accept the results. And people have said to me, Why don't you accept the results? And I've said one thing, that the results are too good to be true for the ruling party. And because of that, I don't accept them. It's like somebody was doing math calculations and it's just across the board like that.
But Biggie, you need to present proof of wrongdoing, of irregularity, of voter rigging. Before you can come to that conclusion, do you have proof of what you are saying despite your suspicions?
Well, like I said, in the coming days, we will present that proof. What is happening now is that we are getting people telling us that they realized ABC happening during the voting. But it's still early days. The vote count ended today. And I can assure you, Peter, in the coming days, we will have that concrete proof. But like I said, I'm one of the few opposition leaders who just from gut feel said, no, these results are too clean. These results, are unbelievable. And I'm just, the first to say that I reject the results unconditionally. And I can assure you, because Botswana is such a small population, we are all almost related to one another, we will know the truth of what happened on the 23rd.
Biggie Butali is the leader of the opposition Botswana Patriotic Front, BPF. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. Makerere University students have petitioned Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni to address their concerns, which led to last week's protest. The protest, they say, led to the arrest of at least 46 students, while several others have been treated for various degrees of injury. The students blame the police and the school authorities for the arrest and for the refusal of the police to adhere to a court ruling. It ordered the arrested student to be released after 48 hours in detention in accordance with the law. Judith Naluwago, vice president of the Makerere Students Guild, tells me the student body has also petitioned parliament to reconsider the increasing fees.
The court released an order that since the 48 hours have elapsed for the students to stay in the police cell, then the students should be released. But we took it to the police and the police refused. They were like, they're not going to follow the order. And for them, they're waiting for an order from the university administration. That's when they will release the students.
And have you contacted the university authorities to have them give the order that the police require in order to release your fellow colleagues?
And the university administration is being stubborn, very stubborn. They just want, what they want is to keep students in cells because they don't want the students to demonstrate anymore. Because they know the students are demonstrating for the right cause and they do not want to meet the students' interests. So they are determined to keep them in the cells.
But some people are saying that the students have not been negotiating with the school authorities in good faith. And instead of coming to them to resolve them, you go into the street and demonstrate against them just to make them unpopular.
Actually, this strike was actually coordinated by the students themselves. In most cases, what happens is the student leaders who start the strike. But this one was started by students because since we came into authority in March, we've been dialoguing with management and we've been on table with management and we've been addressing these issues, especially about tuition increment. And we've been talking, they keep on referring, okay, we shall talk about it next time, we shall do this next time, we are going to do this like every other time, they keep promising. The students check on us, what has happened? We tell them management has said this. 2 weeks back, that is when we had the last meeting with management, with the general guild house, and the management told us tuition is a no-go area. We can do what we want, but they're not going to do anything about tuition. That's what spiked off the demonstration among students.
So what are you going to do now, since the school's management is not budging on the cumulative 15% tuition increment, which they said is necessary to run the affairs of the university and ensure that it is a safe environment for students to learn? What's next for you?
Our university is a public university. Who's running is mostly by the government. 65% of the university's running is given by the government, i.e. that is taxpayers' money. That means this is a public institution that is supposed to cater for the poorest background students. So only the university has to meet 45%, which they get from donors, which they get from grants, and which they get also from tuition. When they were increasing tuition, they cited some things they wanted to improve in the university. So even after the tuition has increased for 2 years now, nothing of the things they've cited. Actually, everything in the university has gone worse. Everything is worse than it used to be. So students are saying, even after getting a lot of money from us, what are you doing with the money that we are giving you? After they had increased tuition, immediately the next year, the number of dropouts, the quality assurance, recorded that there were 2,500 students that dropped out of the university because they could not afford the tuition. The same quality assurance recorded that in just one school of the university, 173 students from School of Social Sciences were not able, just one school, to do exams because they lacked tuition. Again, in the same exact year, that is when the university broadcasted names in newspapers of students that had failed to pay tuition. That means tuition has become too much for the students, that the university is even supposed to publish the names of the students in newspapers.
Well, so, Judith Nalugwabo, what is next? What are you going to do now?
What we've done, we filed a petition with Parliament of Uganda. The Parliament right now is in recess, and they're resuming on Tuesday, and that is one of the things they're going to tackle first when they come back from recess. And we've also written a letter to the President to look into our issues, because the government says the increased funding of the university. So why is the university still extorting a lot of money from the students? So we want the government to look into it. Then, as students, we are not stopping our demonstration till the university agrees to our demands, because we cannot keep on studying halfway and we don't do exams. It doesn't make sense.
Judith Nalugwabo is the vice president of the Makerere Student Guild. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The Ethiopian Catholic Archbishop of Addis Ababa has welcomed as a positive step the Nobel Peace Prize awarded to Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. Cardinal Bene Jesus Demiro Sorofield, who is also the Chancellor for the Catholic University of Eastern Africa, says a new policy is being implemented that will ensure a continuation of government project by successive government. He says this will help efforts to improve the living conditions. Cardinal Sorofield also tells me that he expects next year's elections in Ethiopia will be free, fair and transparent.
I was really very, very happy, delighted, because that was the reaction of many Ethiopians, not only in Ethiopia, but all over the world.
So there's a new policy of MEDEMER, synergy. Talk to me about it. What are your views? How will it impact the people of Ethiopia?
Well, the philosophy of MEDEMER, synergy, signifies that a country is built up through various contributions of past governments, past cultural and traditional values. You don't have to start from zero every time. Turn over a government, destroy everything what they did, and start new. You can build on what you have by taking the positive ones, strengthening those, and say cleaning up from within. So that is the idea of MEDEMER, that everybody is involved and can add can add his own or her own values to transitional period.
Some people have expressed concern about the current political and security situation in Ethiopia. What is your take on that, and how can this be resolved for the people of Ethiopia?
Yes, because now Ethiopia is in a transitional time, and also being in a process of being prepared for an election to come in May. And so with all this, there are many who want to preserve their own political interest, their own wealth, which they have, amassed before. And because of that, there is tension. But usually the tension is created. It is not from the people themselves. The people are peaceful people, and many of them struggling for their daily livings to educate their children and live peacefully with their neighbors.
What are your expectations for the elections in May? Do you expect it to be peaceful, transparent, credible?
Yes, I'm really praying that next election will be very democratic and very peaceful and just, because elections need always strong democratic institutions. You could take, for example, the court or the security or the election board and the parliament. All these democratic institutions need to be strengthened every election. And we hope once you build the institutions, you will have more and more democratic elections.
Before we go, when you meet these political leaders, as an influential religious leader, what do you tell them about improving the lives of people, maintaining peace and good neighborliness?
Well, what I tell them, whatever position they have, whatever political power they have, and if they think so, it belongs to the people. It's the people who have put them there. And they are there now, but tomorrow they might not be there. I always challenge them, what is going to be your legacy? That's my question to them.
Cardinal Bene Jesus Demiro Serafel is the Chancellor for the Catholic University of Eastern Africa. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. The U.S. military says there are now fewer than 150 Islamic State fighters left in Libya. That's a huge reduction from earlier this year, when an AFRICOM official said Islamic State had as many as 750 members in Libya. Our Pentagon correspondent Kalabab has details.
Speaking exclusively to VOA, U.S. Africa Command's Director of Public Affairs, Colonel Chris Carnes, said the military saw a regeneration of Islamic State forces and, with coordination from the Libyan government, decided to strike.
So they were gathering in camps where they were doing some of the basic training and starting to do some of the recruiting, and consequently airstrikes were conducted. So 43 Islamic State fighters have been taken out of Libya permanently. Right now, when you look at the numbers, it's under 150.
The deteriorating security situation allowed the militants to expand their presence in ungoverned spaces. Troops affiliated with the Government of National Accord are battling forces led by strongman Khalifa Haftar, killing hundreds of people caught in the middle of the fight this year.
Our concern was that with the civil war, these terrorist groups, in particular ISIS, would look to leverage this opportunity to grow, to recruit, to train, and create additional chaos in a situation that is already chaotic.
Islamic State in the country's south has claimed responsibility for several deadly attacks against Libyan civilians and military personnel. But the group is now a fraction of what it was in Libya in 2016, when there were an estimated 4,000 to 6,000 fighters. The U.S. military carried out about 500 airstrikes against the Islamic State fighters that year, condensing them to a small stronghold around the coastal town of Sirte before their ultimate defeat. Carnes said that overall, AFRICOM has seen just a trickle of Islamic State come to Africa from the Middle East this year, rather than the flood of fighters many feared would saturate the continent after the terror group's territorial defeat in Iraq and Syria in March. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Nnamdi Kanu is the head of the indigenous people of Biafra, or IPOB, a group agitating for what it says is the independence and restoration of the state of Biafra. He's also an activist who was recently released from prison after Nigerian authorities accused him of treason. He has often championed a strategy of civil disobedience to press home IPOB's demands to free his people. However, his critics say he is a rabble-rouser who seeks to undermine Nigeria's unity as well as its territorial integrity. Nnamdi Kanu joins me live in the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. How are you, Nnamdi?
Thank you very much, Peter. Thanks for having me here.
All right, so you said you want to free your people.
Yes.
What does this mean and what does that entail?
It means the total, unequivocal extrication of the territory of Biafra from the present contraption, or should I say a British contraption known as Nigeria. Complete and total sovereignty for the state of Biafra.
So you want to be independent or secede from Nigeria, correct?
We are not actually seceding. We are going back to the way we were before the British came.
So do you think the authorities in Nigeria, as it stands now, one, an indefeasible, or as authorities say, the separation of Nigeria is unwarranted and will not be entertained in any circumstances. Do you think your objective is achievable?
It is achievable because you would expect any dictatorial state, you would expect any backward banana republic, which Nigeria has become, to speak in exactly those terms. But what they have cleverly forgotten is that they are the instigators of separation. They are the ones making the polity ungovernable. They are the ones going about pillaging, killing, sacking villages and occupying them. They are the ones that have taken nepotism to a new and unbelievable level. They are the ones running Nigeria as if it is a private family business. They are the ones that have promised and sworn to bring Islam into Biafra land. They are the ones arming and equipping the four known terror groups you have in Nigeria to cause havoc and kill innocent people. We are not going to fold our hands and watch this continue to happen. The same set of circumstances obtained in 1966, when over 300,000 Biafrans were slaughtered in the north, that led to the declaration of the state of Biafra in 67. This time around, we are far more prepared, far more knowledgeable, far more aware, and far more exposed to allow the same thing to happen to us again. They promised to Islamize and to colonize us, but we will not allow that to happen.
So let me ask you this. Recently, when Nigeria held elections, you made a proclamation about a support for one party or another. People said, if you want an independent state, why support a party to participate in an election that you don't believe in, that really undermines your objective of having an independent state of Biafra?
First of all, we are Democrats, and secondly, we did not advocate for the voting of any particular party. What we said very clearly is that the policies of APC, as championed by the cabal who are in charge in Abuja, is not sustainable and cannot be supported. We also wanted to demonstrate our ability to be flexible and more so to respond to the yearnings and aspirations of our elders who demanded and pleaded with us to allow the voting to go ahead. But what I can say to you is that voting in Nigeria, as you've well seen, thankfully you were there to observe it, is not only shambolic, but is an exercise in futility. Voting doesn't count in Nigeria. People voting in Nigeria is a wasted effort. All the ballot boxes, all the ballot papers, all the polling stations belonging to Biafrans in Lagos, for instance, Abuja, Kano, Kaduna, and Zaria, were all destroyed during the election day, rendering it absolutely useless. What they have said to us is that we do not belong to Nigeria. We are not part of Nigeria. It is even a worse form of apartheid than what obtained in South Africa. Those are the conditions we are being forced to live under. Where the circumstances allowed us to participate, of course, we said we are lifting the boycott. But as you can see, regardless of what you do, the outcome is always predetermined. The Fulanis in the north will always write the results, and the army will enforce it, and the court will rubber stamp it, and that's where we are, today.
Does your course entail in engaging with the government to achieve your objective, or does that also entail picking up arms against the administration or the state of Nigeria?
Not at all. We are averse to picking up arms. We are not interested in armed struggle. We believe that ideologically and intellectually that this war can be won and won very convincingly. Therefore, there will be no recourse to armed conflict. But in terms of dialogue, you can't say no to discussing with people. If they want to discuss the terms of separation, we are more than willing to accommodate them. But one thing is obvious. We are not going to stop until Biafra is restored. Our approach of civil disobedience and making sure that nothing functions that will benefit the central government in Nigeria continues unabated. We don't intend to slacken. We don't intend to retreat any iota. And believe you me, that Biafra will come in the not-too-distant future. I'm very confident of that.
What does the state of Biafra mean for the people of the land?
It is the kingdom of heaven upon the face of this very earth. What we have seen and continue to see since the creation of Nigeria is a level of backwardness and regression which nobody ever envisaged. Not even those that fought the British for independence could have foreseen what Nigeria would become in some decades down the line. What you're seeing is a new level of what I call primitivity in governance, a new level of poverty, a new level of backwardness, a new level of what they have done, in essence, is to destroy every fabric that sustains any modern viable democracy. By any stretch of the imagination, you couldn't possibly describe Nigeria as a civilized, viable country. All the places that I've been to touring the world, speaking to policymakers and influencers, have led me to believe that no one has any hope that Nigeria will survive. And I can assure you, it will not survive. With this reign of terrorism, this brutal repression of free speech, this clampdown on the very core tenets of democracy, that there is no way that the Fulani template for Nigeria can survive the next 5 years. I do not envisage it.
Some people have said that what you are advocating invariably puts your supporters, and for that matter, the Igbo community, in danger, not only in Nigeria, but the rest of the world. How do you react to that?
We know that freedom is very expensive. We are here in the United States of America, where people fought and died and sacrificed their lives to sustain what is arguably the most civilized modern nation on the face of the earth. We recognize those sacrifices, and it is something that we're prepared to make. If ultimately, at the end of this very process, there is only one Biafran man and one Biafran woman left, we will make do with that. They can go ahead and procreate and create the future Biafra nation. What we must state very clearly is that nobody should underestimate our resolve. We are determined. My mother have just died as a result of this very effort. Many more have gone, and we are prepared to sacrifice whatever it takes to ensure that Biafra is restored. Because it's not just the hope of, say, the Biafrans themselves. Biafra will save other ethnic groups within Nigeria. And Biafra, I believe very strongly, is the beacon and the hope and the light of Africa. Once Biafra stands as an independent entity, believe you me, you will record development and progress within the wider Africa. But without Biafra, none of that will ever happen.
Some Igbo monarchs have petitioned or have requested and urged the government to allow you to come back home and give your mother, your deceased mother, a befitting burial. What is your stance on that?
My mother died as a result of the agitation for Biafra. And she made it very clear when she was alive that anything that I have to do to ensure that Biafra is restored is what I must do. And asking anybody to allow me to go back home to bury my mother is not part of that plan and is not part of that agreement. I have not asked anyone to speak to or lobby anybody on my behalf, and I will not, and I will not accept any, should it come across to me. What we are trying to say is this. I am not interested in going back to bury my mother, if that will entail the killing, disappearance, and extrajudicial torture, as they always do, against our people. We are not, I repeat, we are not going to do anything to jeopardize the lives of our people. But one thing is certain, that my mother will be buried. I may be there, I may not be there, but it will not come via the dictates or the permission of the Asoro cabal that currently run Nigeria.
Let me ask you this. Some of your critics are saying the advocate for the state of Biafra is inward looking, is tribalistic, as they said, or ethnic centered state, and that you are seeking the disintegration of Nigeria, which they said is unacceptable because it questions the territorial integrity of the state of Nigeria.
Who created Nigeria? The British. Are they Nigerians? Are the British people, are they Africans, by any stretch of imagination? Is Frederick Lugard an African? What they're trying to say, in essence, is that because Nigeria was created by Frederick Lugard, somehow it confers upon it certain legitimacy which Nnamdi Kanu, as a black African man, is not entitled to question. That's what I'm saying. We keep forgetting that Nigeria is an artificial creation. It never existed until Lugard came. There was nothing called Nigeria before the British set their foot on that part of West Africa. Therefore, what we are trying to do is to return us to the basics, to the way we were before they came. Some people have argued, and I would say not very convincingly, that we should just move on from here. The only thing you can give a name and it bears that name is your pet, either your cat or your dog. By accepting the name Nigeria, what we have done in essence is to say we are not capable of creating a civilized society by ourselves and for our people. Are you telling me I can go to Europe and create a nation in Europe? Are you remotely suggesting that I can come to the United States of America, carve out perhaps the state of California, and then give them whatever name that I like? Does Nigeria even have a meaning? Nigeria is a nigger area. That is the meaning of it. It is a nigger, a place for niggers. That's the meaning of Nigeria. That is the appropriate pronunciation. Are you suggesting that we should adopt such a name for our people? Why can't Africans come together and give themselves the name that they feel that they deserve? Ghana was formerly called Gold Coast, and they changed it because the people took ownership of their destiny. Why can't something happen within Nigeria? Why? Let me tell you this. The only reason why people are apoplectic about Biafra when it's mentioned and our need for freedom is they fear for their well-being in terms of their access to oil and gas in Biafra land. All the resources that sustains Nigeria, that makes it the so-called giant of Africa, is located within Biafra. The oil and gas is within Biafra. The manpower is within Biafra. So when people talk about this fear of breaking up Nigeria, it is because they are afraid that they cannot survive on their own.
But I'm not cutting you short, but we have an instance where South Sudan came out of Sudan, where Sudan lost approximately over 60% of its natural resources. It's now trying to jumpstart its economy and all that. Do you want that for Nigeria as a people, a country that has lasted for nearly 60 something years? Is this what you want for the people that you've grown up with, you went to school with, the country is still thriving, a bastion of commerce on the continent?
But the same argument could be made for Ethiopia. You've just spoken to the Archbishop of the Catholic Church in Addis Ababa, extolling the virtues of the Prime Minister. The reason why he received the Nobel Prize is because Ethiopia is outward looking. They recognize and acknowledge all these various agitations. They also accept the need for people to exert their identity and for people to take ownership of who they are. Eritrea came from Ethiopia. The world did not come to an end. If the idea is to ensure that economically Nigeria does not collapse, I have said it, and I will also go on record here on VOA to say it once again, that we will be prepared to pipe oil and gas to every region within Nigeria. We are prepared to share the natural resources in Biafra land with all the relevant and component parts of Nigeria to demonstrate very clearly that our agitation has nothing to do with the economic emasculation of Nigeria, but has everything to do with our right as a people to determine where we want to go to. Ours is about self-determination, and our people must... You must also know that half of the Yoruba race is in Dahomey, in Benin Republic. That is the danger of having Europeans come to Africa to draw your boundaries for you. We are basically operating in this present-day Africa, the boundaries drawn up in 1884 by Otto von Bismarck in Germany. Do you think that is fair? I don't think it is. And it is the duty and responsibility of Africans to apply African solutions to African problems. The idea that you can come to Africa and just say, you, from today you are all Nigerians, I think is laughable. You cannot do that anywhere else, only in Africa. Why must we allow it?
Before we go, Nnamdi, what do you expect for your people in the next 5 to 10 years' time in this struggle to establish what you described as a Biafran state?
My expectation is that in the not too distant future, there will be Biafra. If there is no Biafra, believe you me, the consequences will be disastrous for everyone. The Middle Belt people are suffering. Even for the very first time, they're bringing their murderous carnage into the Yoruba land. I shouldn't call it Yoruba, actually. It's Oduduwa, because we've been told that Yoruba means something completely different. It's Oduduwa. Now they have come into the West. They have pillaged and have sacked the Middle Belt. And in Biafra land, as we speak, we are under attack. Continuing with one Nigeria means surrendering our land, our way of life, to an alien culture from the Sahel. It is not something we are prepared to countenance. I assure you this. No matter, regardless of what it would take to ensure the coming of Biafra, that is exactly what we are going to do. I do not see Biafra, in fact, to be honest with you, I see Biafra coming before the next 10 years. I can say that to you very categorically. If Biafra doesn't come within the next 10 years, there will be no peace in that part of the world, because we cannot stand idly by and watch them rape our mothers, abduct our daughters, massacre and rape at will. It cannot just happen. No sane, sensible person will be able to withstand that. Everybody knows. I don't know why the media in the West doesn't talk about what is happening in Nigeria. You have the Fulani headsmen who have come with the full and total support of the Nigerian state to wreak...
The government has said that the government has stepped up efforts to increase security, bolster security in certain areas where Boko Haram and terrorist groups have been fighting. So the government is doing something about it. This is what the government is saying. Are you saying the government is not doing its job, which is constitutionally mandated to protect life and property?
What is Boko Haram operating in the north, isn't it? Boko Haram is in the north. ISIS in West Africa in the north. Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb from the north. Fulani headsmen from the north. Only these people from the north is responsible for sponsoring 4 frontline terror groups around the world. Only them. And where do you have Operation Python Dance in Biafra land? Where do you have Operation Crocodile Smile in Biafra land? There is no singular military exercise going on in the north. They are running away from the battlefields. All the money that they get from the USA, all the military assistance they get from all over the world is geared towards suppressing civilian populations in the south. Nothing is happening in the north. When was the last time that VOA heard of any pitched battle between the Nigerian armed forces and the terrorists in the north? None. But they're down in the south, killing, pillaging, assisting, basically forming themselves as the vanguard for the terrorists to come in and take over. That is what is happening, and that's the reality on the ground. All the lies that the Nigerian government have been telling the whole world about how they are battling Boko Haram, we have been puncturing all of that. I've been in the U.S. now for getting to over a week, and we've been doing a lot of work, I can assure you of that. And very soon, all will unravel, because now the policymakers here in this very great capital of a very great nation understand what Nigeria is up to. How come they gave Mietiala 100 billion naira, which roughly translates, I think, is about 800 million naira, dollars. From where did they get that money from? This is the fourth most deadly terrorist group in the world. The government themselves are actively encouraging them by paying them to go and take over lands belonging to other people.
Well, we'll continue with this discussion another time. Nnamdi Okwukanu is the head of the Indigenous People of Biafra, or IPOB. He joined us live from the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Winnie Kumalo with Impilo, and then Tiwa Savage featuring Rude Boy, and it all with My Heart. I'm not afraid to die.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot climb to the mountaintop without crushing some weeds with your feet. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.